This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello. Hello, I'm Brad Lighthouser, and I hope I can be heard. It's my honor tonight to introduce Richard Powers, and I wanted to offer an unusual, unconventional introduction, because I think Richard Powers is such an unusual and unconventional novelist. So I wasn't going to stick to reciting his resume. I gather you get some of that in your program anyway. And then I realized that nothing could be less unusual and unconventional than the task I had set for myself, which is to say nothing could be more typical and predictable than the person getting up, as I plan to do, and to say that we're going to hear someone who is unusual. So I thought, you know, how often do you actually come here and somebody says what you're going to hear tonight is a writer who I think is very typical and reflects most of what is going around on the literary scene. And it could easily be frequently mistakable for someone else. I'm tempted to point out, in a parenthesis that could quickly widen to engulf the rest of the evening, that although plenty of wonderful artists have, in fact, been mistakable for someone else, I think of all those paintings that have been called masterpieces when attributed to one artist that are subsequently attributed to another and are still masterpieces. But that's an issue hardly relevant here, given that Powers is, and though it's so predictable of me to say so, so unpredictable and distinctive. So as I thought about what I wanted to say in this introduction, I began to mull over the notion of what makes Richard so distinctively himself, or what makes any artist distinctively himself or herself. And while doing so, I came upon this quotation from another American novelist, not Powers. Here's my quote. She never wore round her throat a broad red velvet band. If she had, moreover, would it ever have served so to carry on and complicate, as he now almost felt, his vision? I'm hoping that at least some of you are nodding your heads knowingly and murmuring under your breath, Henry James. That is, in fact, our friend Strether in The Ambassadors. And the whole sentence, while the whole sentence is unmistakably James, it seems to me it becomes the essence of James, in the phrase, to carry on and complicate as he now almost felt his vision, and becomes essence of James when you get to the phrase, as he now almost felt. What is it like to almost feel a complication? I don't know. But James does, and that's why we go to him. It seems it's finally, I think, a kind of act of literary paleontology, this question of how small a bone do we need to identify and reconstruct an entire creation, an entire imagination. I remember years ago reading a poem in which I came across the phrase, I hope some of you will recognize, orange, bland, ambassadorial. Each of those adjectives, rumpling, enriching, and effacing its predecessor, it seems to me, orange, bland, ambassadorial. Well, that has to be Robert Lowell. It could not be anybody else, it seems to me. And so now we have three words that define a literary sensibility or identify one. I think John Cheever, one of my very favorite American writers, often does this with word pairs. Let me just read some Cheever sentences or phrases. Ralph's imagination remained resilient and fertile. Well, you hit that resilient and fertile, you say, well, that's Cheever, of course. The phrase, something preposterous and descendant. Well, I guess that's Cheever again, isn't it? Some marvelously practical and obdurate part of myself. Practical and obdurate, we know who we're talking about. And I think my favorite phrase probably in all of John Cheever, a world that lies spread out around us like a bewildering and stupendous dream. Well, you hit that bewildering and stupendous. Two words, as I say, but it's clear who the author is. So I'm going here from three words in the case of Robert Lowell, to two words in the case of John Cheever as identifying characteristics. I think zero words identify my friend Richard Powers, I speak only somewhat hyperbolically, but it occurs to me when I look at my copies of his books that you don't have to enter the books themselves to know it's a Powers novel. You merely have to look at the things that I, or any reader like me, writes in the margins or at the fronts of the books. I just sort of picked up a few, some examples of things I've noted and written down while reading Powers, and these are very peripheral, I have to tell you, to anything that's going on in his novel itself. I noted that polarize and paralyze would make a neat off-rhyme. So would homeroom and honeymoon. It occurred to me that the title Two One Ways might be useful. I have a long paragraph about the relationship between meter and rhyme that I scribbled in the margins of one of his books. I have another long paragraph, so enthusiastic as to be often unintelligible, about the relationship between authenticity and counterfeit, counterfeitship, or whatever the noun is, in art. I wrote to myself, if there are overlords, are there underlords, and who would they be? Is the American dream a journey from the promised to the promissory land? I noted that the words hideous and hideout are only one letter apart. These are not phrases that appear in his books, as I say, and they may seem silly doodling to some of you, but I trot out my little motley catalog as a way of saying that Powers gets your imagination going in all sorts of, yes, that word again, unpredictable, often antic ways. If his books are constantly reminding us that good readers are always writing the book before them as they read, he himself is the embodiment of that notion. I guess what I'm saying is that his books perform a wonderful and, if I may indulge one more cliche, subversive task. They get you thinking. And with that phrase, I will leave you to Mr. Powers. Thank you.
I honestly don't remember my first visit to the blog Speculum Ludi, but the lapse isn't entirely my fault. This was the web 2.x, a word tossed casually into a search engine while procrastinating on a stubborn chapter. A few clicked links, a traced trackback or two, and 6 hours later, you emerge from the seething spawn of energy drink and guarana-fueled micro-communities, shaky, anemic, and needing to phone your grandmother about Hummel figurines. But both my grandmothers were dead, and as with most other mysteries in creation, Speculum Ludi's creator, Funes the memoirist, had a pretty good theory about who'd gotten to them. I've lost my sense of chronology, although the exact times of every one of my thousands of visits to Speculum Ludi must still be recorded on several servers. I'm fairly sure how I found the site. It must have been the mirror neurons. For some months, in the run-up to my 50th birthday, I've been feeling the unmistakable symptoms of cognitive decline. I was uncharacteristically slow in recognizing people I hadn't seen in a while. I had trouble gauging how much time had elapsed since any given event. I could no longer decide whether certain celebrities from my childhood had died last year or a decade ago. I thought about talking to my primary care physician, but was afraid he might laugh me out of his office. So I began making the rounds of the various beyourowndoc.coms. And on one of those rounds, I came across what the neurologist V.S. Ramachandran has called the single most important unreported, or at least unpublicized, story of the decade. Something that was going to do for psychology what DNA did for biology, provide a unifying framework and help explain a host of mental abilities that have hitherto remained mysterious and inaccessible to experiments. And once I'd come across mirror neurons, it was only a matter of time before I stumbled upon Speculum Ludi and its lone blogger, Funes. Back then, Funes was posting about mirror neurons roughly once every 3 days. And through that miracle of prosthetic intelligence that my own brain had long ago assimilated as its birthright, Google took me to Speculum's very first entry on the topic from mid-March 2005 where Funes, in his breathless style, Camille Paglia meets Nova, recounted the mind-bending discovery. Underneath a banner proclaiming 12% more scientifically accurate than the leading literary blogs, Funes had posted,
"Picture a laboratory in Parma, Italy, early 1990s, where a team of neuroscientists under the direction of Giacomo Rizzolatti are exploring the premotor cortex of macaques. The team tunes tiny electrical probes to detect the firing of individual neurons. They find a neuron in the macaque's brain that fires only when the monkey reaches out to grab a piece of food. When the monkey's arm stops, so does the neuron. Picture a defenseless mammal wired up to detection devices, the faint signal passing from thought into deed. One more impenetrable philosophical conundrum quantified. But even the neuroscientists aren't ready for what happens next. Between experiments, the neuron starts to go crazy, even though the monkey is perfectly still. The macaque's premotor cortex is moving something, but not its muscles. Then the team sees what has happened. One of the scientists, Fogassi, was reaching for the monkey's banana when the neuron reacted. Fogassi's hand triggered sympathetic movement inside the monkey. The same neurons that move the monkey's muscles are being pirated to make imaginary arm movements, what Rizzolatti takes to calling motor ideas."
Although he wrote like a frustrated suspense novelist, Funes the memoirist turned out to be, if not 12% more accurate than the leading literary bloggers, at least as accurate as most neuroscience journalism. Every fact in his account checked out. The entry titled "Monkey See, Monkey Do" closed by asking,
"So why do humanity's most ingenious breakthroughs always depend on buck-naked luck?"
I spent more time on the site than I meant to before remembering my original search. Several more hours of browsing produced no useful information about my own symptoms, except for a few obsolete articles championing ginkgo biloba and a love fest for the antioxidant powers of blueberries. But I did come across a news aggregator for neuropharmacological developments, which, for a while, produced some mild placebo effects all its own. Meanwhile, back in Life 1.0, I began to block on names more frequently. I lost my ability to hum tunes, even familiar ones, without stumbling over the easiest intervals. Convinced that the do-it-yourself diagnosis sites were giving me new symptoms, I swore off the medical self-help and returned to my usual circuit of daily web rituals, The Times and Gadget /Dot YouTube. But twice over the next few days, I found myself trawling back through Speculum Ludi. I couldn't get Rizzolatti's motor ideas out of my head. I wanted to read that discovery story again, to check it against my memory. But Funes had already put up new mirror musings since my last visit.
"Guess what, folks?"
he begins another of his ecstatic posts from the beginning of that spring.
"EEG and fMRI technologies you are allowed neither to doubt nor have opinions about suggest that humans, too, are crawling with mirror circuits. Their tendrils seem to spread into all kinds of brain areas, speech and learning, facial decoding, emotional perception. It's a storyteller's dream. Doing and imagining share the same hardware. If you find this whole 500 trillion synapse thing a bit of a shark jump, and who doesn't, then get this. The primary visual cortex requires more blood when we merely imagine a scene than when we actually see it. People who simply imagine running can raise their heart rates. Subjects who visualize physical exercise for an extended period gain 2/3 as much muscle strength as those who do the real exercises. Who says there aren't great these aren't great times to be a prostrate intellectual?"
My own circuits came alive with the idea. Even real neuroscientists on more sober websites were buzzing with the implications. But no other public mention of mirror neurons was as wildly exploratory as Funes, or as frequently updated. So I found myself hanging around, despite myself, reading every speculation on the topic the unauthorized blog thought to make. For several posts, Funes continued to link to research corroborating his claims. But an entry the following week traveled beyond anything then verifiable. In a long, rambling outing, Funes claimed that Rizzolatti's mirror neurons underlay our ability to interpret others' actions, to learn by imitation, to exchange meaningful speech, and even to decode art. He cited some token sources, but hard data wasn't exactly what mattered to him. What mattered were all the detonations currently going off inside the memoirist's brain. By the end of the piece, his prose strained to reach escape velocity.
Science has laid bare the neurological basis of empathy, brain maps, mapping other brains as they're busy mapping the territory. Inside your own mirror circuitry, your brain simulates the brain of every stranger you meet. That cashier's smile or policeman's scowl forms on your own virtual lips, as if you generate it yourself, which in effect you do. And every facial gesture that you yourself make launches a whole magnetic storm inside other cortices.
I don't know what haunted me more, the idea itself or his urgency in the face of it. What difference did it make to this man what was going on inside anyone else's cortex? He clearly wasn't a scientist. How big could this blog's audience be? Who were all these blog messages for? On Technorati, I determined that exactly three other blogs linked to his. All of them were ghost ships of the Internet, as minuscule and invisible as speculum ludi. Two of them hadn't been updated in months. Yet nosing around the place gave me weird comfort. I would work for an hour on my own manuscript, the slow trimming and tedious verifying that made for telling stories. Then, feeling the twinge of familiar complaints, a dulling of certainty or fuzzing of words, I would drift instinctively back to Funes, whose wild formulations on motor ideas stayed with me longer than the corridor conversations I shared with my real-world colleagues. I bookmarked the site, and the mere physical location of the link in a folder called New Ideas, two-thirds of the way down my favorites list, triggered a feeling of happy expectation. I felt the mysterious anticipation I'd once felt in the autumn of my 16th year when I began to discover words. Intellectually, I knew that no development in brain science could change who we were here at eye level. After all, the discovery of a Y chromosomal atom who'd lived as recently as 60,000 years ago failed to prevent Rwanda, Bosnia, or Iraq. Nothing some denizen of the blogosphere claimed about laboratory breakthroughs changed the fact that I could no longer dial familiar phone numbers without seizing up. And yet, the idea of it, other people inhabiting my private movements, remaking me in their minds' simulated muscles. While anxiously waiting for Funes' next ode to mirror neurons, I began reading his other posts. Working through them was awkward at best. He dumped several years of prolific speculations into one continuous page, resulting in a vertical scroll button so thin I couldn't grab it with my mouse. In a curt nod to organization, he listed four principal subject categories in a sidebar.
1. Posts that might have gone better without the letter E. 2. Posts my mother taught me. 3. Posts that from a distance could almost be posts. 4. Posts that belong in another category.
Each of those links produced a page of entries as long as the main page. Despite the Dadaist index, his themes were few. He wrote about the new neuroscience. He wrote about fraud and forgery, and about intellectual property rights in the digital age. Every few days, he produced some fanboy appreciation of another obscure and mildly transgressive indie band, talent he referred to as the only printed six of them record club. and he occasionally performed hatchet jobs on public thinkers who got more attention than he did, a category he freely conceded to be far larger than the category of public thinkers itself. In short, a smorgasbord, the grab bag of a brain that refused to tidy itself up for public consumption. After some days of scrupulously ignoring it, I clicked on the diffident apricot-colored link that cowered in the upper right of the page, the one reading, "About Me." The link produced a chunk of text that didn't even fill one screen.
"Welcome to Funes's brain. Current threat level is orange. Funes was born too late to become a programmer and too early to benefit from a diagnosis of Asperger's. Funes is regularly passed over for all major prizes. What doesn't kill Funes can still thrash his mojo. Everyone Funes needs to impress is dead. Funes himself has never shaved the barber. Funes M. Spartacus."
Yet with only the barest sleuthing, I managed to turn up the owner of Speculum Ludi. The author of these pages was a deadbeat associate professor of English named Warren Ballack, who had squeaked through tenure at Montana State University, Bozeman, a couple of decades before on the strength of a book called Thy Peering Eyes, The American Literary Resentment of Science. His departmental page, including a photo of a man who'd never flirted with even visualized exercise, claimed he was currently working on a book called The Fiction of Infinity. But by every indication, he'd published nothing of consequence in the last dozen years. Almost nothing, unless you counted the hundreds of thousands of words that he'd poured into this blog. His sketchy university biography explains several of Funes's entries on the future of literature in the age of technological overproduction. When he wasn't holding forth on mirror neurons, he was lamenting our burial in abundance. The ingenuity of these pieces was surpassed only by their naked desperation, their earnest, plaintive tone out on the fringes of the verbal universe, insisting that a well-formed phrase might still, even now, cobble up some shelter from the flood. One post from the summer of 2005 called "I Only Am Escaped Alone to Tell Thee" produced that sharp click of surprise that I almost never got anymore in those blurry days. I read the paragraph several times, even moving my lips until I could just about hear Funes speaking his own words.
"When I was a child, I built the world out of childish ideas. I truly thought that literature and the Starship Enterprise were on the same mission. Every book I came across was like a fresh planet with altered gravity, an exotic atmosphere, strange kinds of chemistry, unlike anything else in the known quadrant. The point wasn't to decide whether you liked the place. Reading wasn't an exercise in real estate. The point was to beam down to the surface, prowl around the glistening crystal formations, mix it up with the unfathomable native life forms, then try to get back to the ship alive. I remember reading my first Agatha Christie 6 years before I was ready. The plot's mystery was nothing compared to the mystery of the medium. Why were these people carrying on so inexplicably? How did we get from Wednesday to Friday in 5 words? Who was fitting these scenes together for me? And should I trust her? How did you drive this thing? When I became a man, I put away my infinite planets. But somehow I still wanted to believe that novels were closer to sea salvage than they were to air freshener. The longer they'd been lying around waiting to be reclaimed, the more valuable they were. Someday I was going to come across a hand-bound, roughly translated manuscript from Central Asia in a second-hand bookstore, and every classification system I trusted would need rewriting. now like the most perishable commodity. Novels come stamped with a freshness date and are all sealed by regulatory agencies to ensure no harmful additives. Contemporary fiction is served up like those plastic bottles of, quote, pure spring water with the nipple tops. User ratings rush to tell us whether a book is good or bad, but we never ask, good for what? Is a juniper better than a jellyfish? Must we purge the ecosystem of everything that doesn't look like us? Once upon a time, I went to fiction to know what it felt like to be something other than me. Now there's nothing there but the triumph of recognition.
I read his sentences slowly, several times. Of course, I was reading everything slower then, even the sides of cereal boxes, all the while retaining less. But for all its crankiness, Funes's prose moistened a little of that cerebral dry mouth that deadened my days. The strangest of his figures of speech made me feel that I might still make new figures of my own. But possibility is addictive, and addictions grow worse with intermittent reinforcement. Speculum ludi was the perfect one-armed bandit, sporadic enough with its payouts to hook me badly. Late one afternoon in the middle of April, I found myself hitting my browser refresh button as enthusiastically as any Skinner box pigeon. I tried to go cold turkey, but found myself, after a couple of days, browsing the offshore pharmacy sites for cholinergics and other nootropics. After a week of rigid discipline, convinced that Funes had just posted another new bauble, I'd come back for one more peek. Then another, 45 minutes later. To get my days back, I subscribed to an RSS feed on all Funes' posts, flagged with the word mirror. The first one to come across was called Mirrors and Copulation. Both are abominable, his beloved Borges once wrote, for both multiply mankind. In it, Funes recalled another Borges story, The South. A man rushes up a dark stairway and grazes his head against a freshly painted casement that someone forgot to close. At the horror-stricken glance of the first person who sees him, he places his hand to his forehead and feels it covered in blood. The wound becomes infected and the man falls ill, hallucinating images from the Arabian Nights. For a week, he lies near death from septicemia. When he wakes again, his world is inverted, with the line between experience and thought neatly erased. Does the entire story actually take place? Or is the second half just an excursion inward into the fever dream of death? Both readings worked, Funes claimed.
The South itself exists on the knife edge of ambiguity, in the blade's twinned reflections, the literal or the literal.
Then Funes went on to make the absurd claim that the South was autobiographical. He maintained that Borges himself had run up that stairway in real life, grazed his head on that open casement, and thought it the brush of a bird. According to Funes, Borges lay hovering between life and death for 8 days, wrapped in the nightmare of an infected brain. After a long and fitful recovery, Borges feared that the brain fever had destroyed his creativity. Before the accident, he had produced a body of respectable, if recognizable, fiction and poetry. After his illness, he sat down at last for the awful test of what imagination he had left. In that session, he produced Pierre Menard, author of Don Quixote. The story, Funes wrote,
was unlike anything ever written, the first in an outpouring of invention that would lead Borges as close to the mystery of free creation as anyone gets. In a desperate attempt to tap the same source, I have tried a blow to the head, a gash, whatever it takes. Alas, when I sat down to rewrite Pierre Menard, the results were just the feeble blog you see before you.
The piece smacked of the blogosphere at its most jejune. Pure fantasy. I felt shame for every hour I'd wasted on speculum. Why had I been hanging out here? Because it was safer than going out. easier than letting others see my growing gaps and fumblings. But of the two humiliations available to a fading mind, this solipsism now felt worse. But a day later, in fresh mental distrust, I Googled Funes's claim. And to my bewilderment, the entire consensual hallucination of cyberspace agreed with him. It seemed that on Christmas Eve, 1938, Borges did almost die of septicemia after running up the stairs and scraping his head on an open casement. The unique outpouring of the Borgesian really did arise from the ashes of brain fever. Whether the fever fired that imagination or whether Borges, in his post-mortem joy, simply willed his own transformation into Borges, didn't matter to me. We could come back from barrenness. And like the ink-drawn old hag flipping into the reticent young beauty, all my free-fall panic turned into possibility. I put Speculum Ludi back on my twice-daily rounds, and I watched in fascination over the next several weeks as Warren Balick, tenured master of Manic Free Association, went on a colossal tear. He furiously attacked the White House's war on science.
Put your scriptures away and fund the damn research. Why should tens of thousands die for your superstitious righteousness?
But he was just as merciless toward the left.
All you theorists so intent on debunking empiricism, tell me you're not waiting for the cure, just like the rest of us.
Scattershot stuff, but reviving to watch. He seemed to think that science, far from explaining us, was in the process of making us more mysterious. He wrote, with all the zeal of an autodidact, about the hundreds of distributed subsystems in the brain's raucous mob, 8 mental maps to produce hearing, at least 22 to see. Recognizing a face required a dozen coordinated subsystems. Even speaking a single word required whole symphonies. Funes wrote of regions gone wrong, syndromes as wild as any Borges plot. He described people with bilateral damage to the anterior cingulate, who lost their ability to tell places they'd actually seen from those they'd only heard about. He spoke of people who could no longer identify familiar objects or distinguish between two faces or gauge the relative size of oranges and cherries. He described people who denied that their left arms belonged to them. He took comfort from those who thought they were blind when they weren't, who thought that they could see when they couldn't, who hallucinated cartoon characters in a sea of real people. In a post called Towards a Neural Cosmopolitanism, he wrote,
"Neuroscience says that I is improvised from a loose confederation of hundreds of separate agents. The old, solid, unitary self is the supreme fiction. Comes a day when we wake up face blind, defamiliarized, doubling ourselves, insisting that our own home is an alien mock-up. Literature has always known this, from Gilgamesh to Lost. Stories leach downwards into rivers beneath the sea. Stories are where we can live when solidity vanishes. Brain science is just now proving what fiction has said for millennia. We live as if in the neuron's mirror. Every one of us is another's proxy. You grab the fruit. My cells grasp you. Thousands of interlocked chemical catalyzations cascading through us both, faster than either of us could hope to think. For hope and thought are just two of the self's slower spin-offs. And your cortex rewrites itself as you read these words. This one."
By late June, the blog began to change. The posts grew shorter and lost their titles. But I kept returning for the occasional mad flash of invention that focused my days. Warren's first hint at something really wrong was as obscure as it was abrupt.
"Mother died today,"
he wrote.
"Or maybe it was yesterday. Who the hell knows? It could have been a 90s thing. I don't feel so hot myself."
At the end of that week, he followed that scrap with another.
The clocks have been striking 13 all afternoon.
I thought it was a game. Warren Balick, Bozeman's tenured deadbeat, working his way through famous opening lines of World Lit. His first post of July corrected me.
These fragments are shoring up no one's ruin. I seem to have two options here. Try to keep writing up until the day I can't remember what writing is, or quit now while I still feel more or less like me.
It took me three reads to follow him. When I did, I began hitting the site a dozen times an hour. I couldn't grasp what I was watching, even as it played out in all the privacy of public space.
Literature has stopped helping much. Ridiculously, I'm still waiting for the scientific cavalry. Perhaps the breakthrough treatment will come soon, though not soon enough for me. I'll be like one of those last sufferers from polio. Someday the human brain will function exactly as advertised, all the way up to the finish line. Then one day we'll cure ourselves of humanity altogether.
The words left me sickeningly vibrant. I kept Speculum Ludi up permanently in one of my browser tabs, poised for what the information age calls automatic updates. But Balick never descended into anything so banal as medical details. He was all thought, all hope. The two most sluggish of the self's spin-offs. On July 14, I hit the site first thing in the morning after the news feeds and froze at Funes's greeting.
I don't know who you are or why you've wanted to visit me 413 times over the last 3 weeks. The server log gives your IP address as someplace in Illinois. Beyond that, I don't much want to know. I've imagined you so variously, former lover, proud mentor, furious student, or just some random stranger who thinks he recognizes me. I've imagined you as beautiful, brilliant, or at least interesting. Part of me knows what you're just here for, knows you're just here for the horror show, watching from a safe distance, never even leaving a comment. Part of me wishes you'd just say something. Part of me already knows what you'd say. Whoever you are, I'm down to an accidental visitor every other week. And you? You who come here 10 times more often than I do, looking for God knows what. Should I stop now?
I closed my browser and killed my cookies, my history and my page cache. My heart was pounding. Ancient fight or flight. I'd been caught in something criminal. Identified. For minutes afterwards, my hands shook on the keys. I spent hours convincing myself that anything traced back to me would interest no one. My equanimity returned over the next few days in remembering just how large the internet was. My queasiness subsided. My browsing plummeted across the board. I began writing again, sometimes as much as 2,000 words a day. I didn't exactly avoid Speculum Ludi. I simply didn't go there anymore. Funes had built a story about me from out of his system logs. He could build another from my absence. He was better off without my rubbernecking. The man had more pressing things to do than entertain a famine tourist. In late fall, cleaning up my bookmarks, I saw the URL for Speculum Ludi and thought about the site for the first time in months. Before imagination could stop me, I clicked. Funes had posted only 3 messages since the one that had scared me off. 2 were short notes to himself, a pair of crumbling mnemonics. The 3rd, at the top, was for me.
Hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, my mirror.
I left a comment then at last, but Funes never replied. However often I returned. I checked the site again while writing these words and got a 404 page error, page not found. I tried the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, and Google Cache, but somehow, with what must have been considerable effort, Funes had managed to remove all copies of the site. No trace of it remained, except in me. For the better part of a year, I've tried to revise this story. Sometimes I write him back sooner. Sometimes I never discover his site at all. Often the whole transcript sticks in me with deadly accuracy, exactly as things unfolded. That's the nature of memory, strong when you want it to be weak, and weak when you need it strong. But there must be great survival value in faulty remembering, or we wouldn't be so good at it. My comment to Funes' last post, mercifully deleted from the permanent record, has since improved with much revision. It now reads, "Forget in peace. My motor neurons remember. As someone once wrote, all the world's blogs are the work of a single author
who is timeless and anonymous.
Your words are loose and passing through the mirror. One short trip south, and you're with them."
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, I thought we would start at the end, so to speak, at the very end, you bring up the Borges quote about all of literature having sort of one author. I felt this on a personal level because as I was reading, I felt proud of these lines I had written that, in fact, I had not written. But anyway, tell me a little bit about that. Am I responding? Am I in the wrong way to what you've done?
No, that's terrific. And I have to start, speaking of collaborations, with thanking Brad, who said yes to this event before he had any idea of what it would involve. He really was kind of hoodwinked into the whole thing. And we didn't really get a chance to sit down and look at it until this afternoon. So I'm just very grateful that I could conscript him into this. All the world's books have a single author who is timeless and anonymous. And obviously, the piece is a meditation on whether that's still true now in the internet age, in the blog age, in the age of historical cultural amnesia, right? Because in some ways, this old notion that a writer could somehow have his or her hands on a sense of cultural continuity, of long time, of the canonical books, whatever they were, however they changed over the decades, and somehow write something that was in conversation with all those other works, that's broken down, right? So whatever Borges' quote means now, it means something different than it did in that age when we felt all these books somehow chapters of a single universalist cultural project. That's long gone. But what does it mean to think that books might still be in conversation with each other even when the writers don't know one another's works or the readers? How can we continue to have this conversation in the age of runaway words? And I guess I look to that answer in something like the neuroscience, what neuroscience is telling us about the brain's need for other brains to work properly at all, right? The non-separability of cells, the sense that we are in each other's circuitry all the time.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, this notion of books answering books and that feeling, I mean, at some level, when you're sitting down, this may be a collective process, as you're describing. It's also a solitary and often frustrating and seemingly, as I would like to think, a certain amount of self-pity involved and all the rest as you're carrying this business out. But on a on a sort of practical level, which is to say the day-to-day level we're all living on, and you're sitting there writing the book, how much are you feeling, I'm writing this novel, at some level I'm communicating with novels in the past, how often is that a retrospective clarity when you say, oh, I now see that this comes out of my love of Dickens or Twain, or, you know, is there a sense, does it change as you go along, that sense of working with other writers? Is it with you all the time? What's your...
For me, it really does remain that kind of love letter, you know. Here are the things that fueled my imagination. Here are the things that made me come alive. And I'm going to somehow retell that story or open up a corner of those stories. But so much of what I write is elusive in the sense that between the lines of these books, you see all the other books that launched that project.
What you're saying, it seems to me partly what you're saying is that, or I'd like to think it confirms something I've felt for a long time, is that no matter how bleak any writer's vision, you know, how much the book itself may be a throwing up, a vomiting in the face of the world or whatever. I mean, there are books that are extremely bitter. At some level, irreducibly, there's, I think in the process, almost always anyway, there's something altruistic. There is, what you're talking about is at some level, you're spinning this out in response to the pleasure that you had as a child.
Oh, yeah.
You're spinning. I mean, so that it seems to me there's something almost paradoxical. You look at writers who are famously dark. You know, you read Evelyn Waugh and you think, God, he doesn't like people very much.
But the pleasure is so beautiful.
Yeah, the pleasure that you get from reading him.
Yeah,
and you
think,
well, he doesn't like me, but he's making my day much happier and brighter.
Right.
You know,
right.
And what does that tell us about the sort of riddling nature of literature that, you know, I mean, I think on various levels I would offend him, you know, beginning with being an American.
Yeah.
You know, but you could extend that list. It's fairly extensive, you know. And yet, you know, there have been plenty of days in my life where Evelyn Waugh has been, you know, one of the bright things in it, you know. I mean, there's I guess what I'm trying to do is to talk about, or if you have anything else to say, that sense of working out of gratitude. Because at some level, he too, as he's writing these books, is saying they have to be a kind of thank you. And even if, as they're, and you know, and up yours, they're also a thank you. And that it's in that paradox, it seems to me, that even the darkest literature tends to live.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I think I said what you just said.
But no, as well? Was mine more epigrammatic is my question.
But I don't think that's separable from the way that we read darkness for pleasure, right? I mean, who in this house hasn't said, my God, that was a fantastic book. I cried like a baby. Right, I mean, it's part of that being dismantled in the face of the worst. Who was that? Thomas Hardy, right? Full look at the worst. Mm-hmm. That's what literature wants to do. Right? Mm-hmm. And if you can take a full look at the worst and yet have that worst be whole and harmonious and resonant and just right, there is something just in prowling those regions. Right? And I don't think darkness is an eradication of meaning. I think in a lot of ways it's the source of meaning. And it's our sense of despiteness, it's our sense of nevertheless-ness in the face of darkness that forms the love that underwrites reading and writing, right? That the empathy engine, if you will.
This is bifurcating in two directions. Let go back for a minute. I want to talk about the notion of what I was talking about somewhat in my introduction. You know, introducing ideas, making people think. It has occurred to me, as somebody who reads a lot of novels and writes novels, that what ideas generally are, there, to put this on the most mundane level I can think of, your grocery shopping, you know, ideas are sort of the garlic bagels of in literature.
No, the everything bagels.
No, which is to say they need to be stored separately, you know. When they say to you, you know, do you want those with the cinnamon? You say. And there's a great deal of difficulty integrate. I mean, they're wonderful. You get home, you say, oh, this is what could be more delicious than this garlic bagel, but you don't want it mixed. I mean, one of the things that has interested me as I've read your books over the years is managing to get these, which is a very difficult thing to do, but to get ideas into the books without killing the book itself. No. And it's a huge challenge, and God knows we've all read plenty of books that seem to, you're quite into it about page 30, and then at 60, you're beginning. There's less light and less air. You know, are my eyes going, or is it my lungs? That feeling that some part of the system is beginning to break down, and then it turns out that it's neither, because you put the book down and you go outside and you feel much better. Oh. But it seems to me that
you're waiting for 200, which is going to retroactively turn 60 into something that you had no idea it had the
possibility. I never got to 200 in the cases I'm thinking of, but you're probably right. I did go outside and I had a good time. But anyway, the point is, talk about this, because I think it's a remarkable talent you have you can read. I mean, you know, Operation Water Soul. There's some of these, but you can say there's a kind of governing idea here. This is bifurcating because I want to move from the large to the small in the sort of sentence in a moment. But on the large level, what you're working with is overarching ideas often. And talk about that, or how does that, I mean.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, to put this more crudely than it's ever put, except in major daily newspapers, there are novels of ideas and there are novels of character. You can either have a fictional world that operates basically in a thematic matrix, or you can have this sense of palpable, recognizable, identifiable, you know, human, desperate, emotional interactions. That's not how we work, really. That's a function of artistic, a historical set of conventions. Right, that we've internalized as somehow being, you know, the map of who we are and how we interact with one another. In fact, everything coming out of neuroscience labs in the last 25 years, and I think anything that occurs to you when you really introspect on the way your own mind works, will bring you to the inseparability and actually the interdependence of having emotions about things and having ideas about things. Right? And one does not annihilate the other. They are not at war with each other. They are absolutely in a kind of tandem improvisation, right? Bi-directional reciprocal improvisation. When a human being inside a work of art has an idea, that's character, right? A voiced idea is somebody trying to say, I need the world to look like this. Maybe it doesn't look like that, right? But that's the function. That's a function not of some kind of intellectual as opposed to emotional construct. That's the character hypothesizing about, creating, being destroyed by, and reassembling his or herself in the face of the challenge of experience.
Well, let's stick with this business of ideas, because it one of the things, again, I admire so much about your books, I think it would, as one could, if one wanted to, you could, the term novel of ideas is itself scares people off.
Sure.
If I say I feel that there's an element of paranoia that runs through the books. That seems as though it's a criticism too, but
I'll
be right
back.
But I think as a reader, I mean, one of the things I like so much is I get paranoid reading your books that I'm not. I think of myself as paranoid in this particular sense, but I'm not paranoid enough. Which is to say that what you're doing a lot of social commentary, and one of the things. Let me read a sentence I'd like very much. This is about consumer culture and fashion. It says, it involves engineering into each good or service a time-delayed precipitate of alienating ugliness so that the desperate purchaser will wake up one day from his incredible bender and say, whatever possessed me? Now, that's brilliant. I mean, I think that's it's really one of those, you read these sentences and you just, one is filled with admiration and envy, and again, talk about inseparability, to try to separate those two, one from the other.
And but, in the margin was a note about rhyme and meter?
I immediately went elsewhere. No, but what you're talking about is, there are all sorts of forces that are trying to discourage your reader or my reader, or for anyone out there in the audience who's a writer, your reader as well, from thinking. And those forces, things get shorter. Things get the news, you can't, the assumption is you can't listen as long as you used to. Mm-hmm. The assumption is you can't hold on to a particular thought as long as you need this, at an implicit level, it's obviously, you could say it's insulting, or you could say it's, but it's also brilliantly engineered. I mean, what you're talking about here in that sentence is a kind of brilliant marketing engineering that is going on, but that is designed to make, for example, the novel that is trying to field and think about, and both, as you say, to feel and also to explore on a purely intellectual level ideas. There are various forces at work. One would be foolish. I don't think this is paranoia. I think this is just dead-eye, cool clarity. There are forces at work that are opposed to that, that are saying, don't do that. Don't go there.
Yep. Yeah, and I guess we're back to the piece in a way, right? I mean, the question about whether all the world's books are the work of a single author can survive the internet age. Can a culture of visceral empathy, of interpretation and reflection, survive all of the technologies of appraisal that we've gotten so good at, right? And are now surrounding encouraging us to replace, right, to replace these other modes. In fact, that's, to me, in some ways, the rejection of idea as if it were somehow separate from emotion may be related in a very convoluted way that Brad will explain to you later, with this notion that somehow, as Funes says, what we're getting good at is not reading. We're good at getting really good at saying what we like and don't like. And so we have developed this currency, whatever, these sort of interchangeable evaluations, I'll give it 2 stars, right? Or 5 stars, right? And that somehow, the evaluative acceptance or dismissal of the work is somehow all we're responsible for. Rather than this idea that, no, as a reader, we are responsible for completely rewriting this book. In the viscera of our own, in our own viscera, in our own experience.
Yeah, I think when I talk about, things that it is assumed that you cannot do, having taught at various places, I often teach poetry and among other things, but I'll ask students to memorize, and I it's not as though I have a genius for memorization, but what seem to me extremely short passages that you, and the memorize the first 10 lines of Paradise Lost. Oh, professor, this is such a heavy burden to put upon us. The things that honestly one would have expected, and it doesn't mean that we don't do other things extremely well, no. but certain kinds of and certain skills that seem to me necessary for the reading of poetry and ultimately the reading of novels. I don't know any of you in the audience except one or two, some of you, I presume, are teachers, and you've had the experience of being told, this novel is too long, and it's 300 pages, and this isn't Proust, nor is it Dickens even,
the last reading that I did, and for which I was paid obscenely, asked that I not read longer than 20 minutes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. They may have read my books, and that may have been
decided
part
that
of the problem.
There's a certain repetition that appears around line 18.
Right.
And
20 and
well, we let him go 20 anyway. Right.
I just wanted to add to that. I'm not a Luddite. You know, I was programming, Z80 assembler on a machine that used cassette tape as its storage medium, back in 1977. And many of my books have thematic topics, and I've, over the years have taken this pleasure of writing as a vicarious entry point into various technological careers that I wish I could have followed. But what I'm saying is, we need, having created these tools that can so incredibly expand our throwaway and our field of reference and our own intellect, to decide who we want to be in conjunction with the tools, and to build the kind of tools that we feel expand our temporal understanding and not shorten it, and not replace amnesia and instant gut reaction with reflection.
I want to, as I say, move to the very small. And this is on the sentence-by-sentence level. But one of the great appeals of your books for me is the clear love of poetry, both as expressed or used or lightly alluded to, but also in a certain, every now and then I hit a sentence, and I just think, that is really just, there's not a word here that I would move, and I do like to sort of, try to rewrite anything I, that's part of the pleasure, it seems to me.
Exactly.
Let me just, for the audience, I'm going to read three two sentences and a fragment, but one is this: because the basic four-chambered heart and the standard two-chambered brain were not designed to live in the kind of place they had made of the world. Or here's another. These are two sentences, actually. Sarah's face modulated to seriousness, not oppressive seriousness, not brooding agitation or the end of enjoyment, but a richly textured, nuanced sonata seriousness, the slow weighing of possibilities hidden in a minor key. And I thought the one I think the best, just a phrase, the sound of healing deliverance delayed for so long, forever, the diminuendo clink of the tumblers aligning in the lock of divine plan. And so we're working with ideas, we're working with characters, we're also working with language and words on a one-by-one. And talk about that. I mean, you're obviously taking a great deal of pleasure at what I think of as the sort of, fine poetic level that ultimately is, as I hope my examples would show, ultimately is extractable. It may further your plot, but at the end of the day, there's a pleasure in it that flies free. This is the bird in the rug, but this particular bird in the rug suddenly takes wing and goes and lights up on the windowsill. Tell me about that, about the sort of poetry side of your writing novels.
I think I would like to be a poet when I grow up. We were actually talking earlier today about poetry being the kind of indicator species for all verbal arts, the canary in the coal mines, right? And that what's happened to poetry, namely... You tell them. namely, an art basically for its producers, right, may be happening in some ways to literary fiction, right? And I think in part because it does require a complete restructuring of time in the mind of the reader, which is getting increasingly harder and harder for us to do. But what I found, I think early on, I loved that freedom to a fault, really. And sometimes in the early books you feel like way too many peaks and not enough valleys, you know. And there was a little explosion on every page, you know, or a big, you know, big one if I could get away with it. And it has occurred to me as I've grown older, maybe because I've grown older, that, as Dante says, the stars get their brightness from the surrounding dark, and you almost have to allow a kind of settledness.
A certain amount of sand between the oasis.
Yeah, in order to earn that moment of sharpness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when you talk about, you know, as a poet, or you know, it's what you would want to be when you grow up. Because one of the things I have felt, I mean, I have published, a number of books of poetry, and I've published a number of novels. I can say to somebody without flinching or having my, you know, gaze drop away, I'm a novelist. To say I'm a poet, no, I've written books of poems. Yeah. But it seems such a grand and elevated and wonderful. It does seem to me, finally, the most beautiful thing anybody can do. Yeah. I mean, so to say I'm a poet you are going to be knocked. I would be knocked off this stage by, you know, one of these lights would fall on my head or something. I would not say that here, you know, especially in an audience I don't know. But nonetheless, when you're talking about the role of the poet, because it seems to me that among other things, you know, poetry. It exists in terms of the publishers more and more. It lends a certain credibility or a certain class or a certain. It's a bulwark against despair in the sense that we still do this stuff. Mm. But that more and more. I mean, you look at magazines that used to publish fiction that don't do fiction. I mean, the Atlantic Monthly that used to. I mean, they just drop. The New Yorker that used to run two stories every, you know, would run 100 stories a year, and then let's cut that in half. I mean, I am feeling that the publishing of not all, obviously, but of so much fiction is itself, I mean, among other things, is perceived as a kind of, the heart isn't in it. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not in the wonderful exceptions. I don't mean any of that, but I'm just saying as a publishing phenomena that the heart is not in that.
Yeah.
You feel if you're doing it that, you know, that you exist on sufferance, and it's not a way any serious artist of any sort wants to exist.
It's interesting because it's not as if there's a deficit of these things in society. In a way, we're surrounded by poetry in the shape of the song lyric. Right, there's nobody who goes a day without some exposure to that. That we are absolutely surrounded by incredibly sophisticated and very cleverly made fiction, but it's visual fiction, right? So again, it's the unique ability of prose and poetry on the page to completely reformulate our sense of our own boundaries. And our sense of the passage of time that we're losing, right? Losing out a slow battle to fiction or poetry that I would call real time fiction or poetry, poetry and fiction that keeps us more or less subordinate to the sense of the way that commercial time runs.
Well, you know, it's funny because it seems to me when you try to. You know, step back and step back and step back. I'm going to generalize now. And you know, what is it like? What is it? What is a novel? But if you take 1,000 poems, but you know, you go from Chaucer, you start with Virgil. It doesn't matter. You take 10 poems out of your local little magazine you've never heard of. The common element, it seems to me, if you could pare this down and pare this down, is what a poem is saying is slow down. What a poem is saying when you're starting talking about time. A poem is saying, read this more slowly than you would normally read. Think about, you know.
In fact, if you slow down far enough, you can stop.
Right.
And then you're in the infinite.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this is what. So if this is if this is the common thread with poems, is there a common thread with novels? Are they saying the same thing? Are they saying something different? Step back and step back and step back. What is the novel saying at the.
The novel. Also asks us to slow down, but it asks us to slow down in someone else's life, and it asks us. I mean, it functions by inexorable forward motion, right? So the novel, in short, this is Peter Brooks' phrase, anticipation of retrospection, right? Which is another way of defeating time, right? To be on page 20 and to know that page 300 is already written and to feel deeply ambivalent about racing toward 300, right? Especially in a really good book. And on 298, it's the worst, right? Because you know every new page is changing every page that you read, right? So in a sense, that's another way into the timeless, because it's playing future and past against each other and producing this kind of standing present. Speaking of time, is this a segue?
Yeah, maybe so. Good.
We're probably close.
Anything further you want to...
I did want to say something, and... You know, we are gonna have a lobby interaction. Brad is gonna sign his books. I wanted to say why I'll just be signing programs or anything else that you have aside from books.
He doesn't like them.
This is the first of several very curious decisions that I've made in my writing life, and it had to do with my first novel. Why I've never signed a single book in it. And I have to tell my mother this every time I see her. This book I wrote in my 20s, and it's basically a meditation on a photograph that was taken by the German photographer August Sander just before the First World War. And it's a kind of minuet between... You know, the subject of the photograph, the taker of the photograph, and the viewers, all the people on the other side of the lens, you know, in the other side of time. And it's exploring this question, what makes an individual copy valuable in the age of mass reproduction? When there are a million things that are exactly the same, what makes yours come alive again? Your individual, indistinguishable copy. What gives it magic? What gives it aura again? And the book tells a number, you know, three braided stories that kind of arrive at this conclusion that the authorized copy, the valuable copy, the copy with aura and magic, is the one that you mark up and the one that you turn the pages down and you spill the coffee on and you break the spine of and you say yes in the margin. Or who does this guy think he is in the other margin? And to turn around and say, I'm going to take a limited subset of these and make a kind of collector's edition by passing the author's hand over, it just seemed hypocritical to me. And so I've been foolishly consistent with that ever since. Really not understanding maybe the degree, you know, the number of people who want to feel like they've had some kind of personal connection to the author. And I've always said this, and I'll say it again tonight, and my wife will kick me after the reading. But if you want that personal connection, do write me a letter, and I'll write you back. And you can do whatever you want with that signature.
Good. Thank you.
You're
great.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.